Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:57 p.m. and that is Central Time, and today is October 20th. Well, gold prices were up another $17 today. They weren't quite able to hold the advance yesterday and look like they're closing back in on the $1,800 area. I think on the weekly chart we can very clearly see that there is a triangular pattern forming. We have a sequence of higher reaction lows. We have and there's been a sequence of lower rally highs evident for over a year. And with this narrowing of trade, well, what it is beginning to suggest is that the people who want to buy are willing to buy the dips. The people who want to sell are not waiting around for a sufficient rally. They are coming in quick and trying to push the price down. So we're getting this narrowing of trading, and volatility is starting to ebb. Now, it feels like we're going up and down a lot, but relative to the size of the pullbacks that we saw over the course of the last year, this is comparatively tame. And generally, when we get these triangular patterns, it's consistent with a period immediately before a significant breakout. So then I think it's probably wise to start thinking about, well, in which direction is it likely to break out? Which is, of course, why we spend some time looking at the longer term charts and ask ourselves, well, is this still an uptrend? Because if it's an uptrend, the breakouts, the surprises are generally going to be on the upside. And if this is a top formation, well, then the big surprise will be a break on the downside. And of course, if you look at a sufficient amount of back history, well, then people are going to go back and they're going to look at what happened in 2011 and 12, and that everything was looking rosy, and then it went sideways for a while, and then it broke down, which is exactly what it's doing right now. So let's then just contrast today with what happened in 2011 and 12. Well, back then, the world was coming off of the sugar high from the massive amount of spending that accompanied the response to the credit crisis. And then we started to see governments getting the new religion of fiscal austerity. You had the Tea Party movement come into the balance of power, or control the balance of power in the US. You had the beginnings of the sovereign wealth crisis in Europe, and Germany dictating to, and the creditor nations dictating to the rest of the EU that it was going to be unacceptable to see German pensions go bust because they'd invested in sketchy deals all over the periphery, and that instead the periphery were going to have to pay for their sins, and that atonement for a decade of profligate lending resulted in a firming in the faith of currencies. So we had fiscal austerity become a really fashionable thing, and it steadied up other currencies and it created less demand for gold. And then we had growth returning and technological innovation really sparking interest in all manner of new goods and services, and we had a phenomenal bull market. And against that background, there was less demand for gold or commodities of any flavor for that matter, because we had a massive commodity bear market. Now we're seeing that an increasingly large number of commodities are breaking on the upside, and we're seeing that inflationary pressures are picking up, they're not moderating. And we have governments that are beginning to talk tough on inflation. But talking tough and acting tough are two different things entirely. And you have, for example, Boris Johnson in the UK saying that, oh, inflation's a good thing, and that it helps wages to go up, and doesn't everybody want higher wages? Well, now you're getting higher wages, so that's got to be a good thing, right? And then you've got Rishi Sunak saying, well, maybe we shouldn't be spending quite as much, and perhaps we should try and balance the budget. So you've got level-headed people and rabble-rousers in equal measure. But the reality is that they may be trying to moderate spending, but there's also big plans for additional spending measures. But it's part of the reason why the pound has been firmer. Whereas when we look at what's going on in the USA, well, the Democrats are having an awfully difficult time passing their spending programs, and they keep getting pegged back. But there's nobody talking about fiscal austerity. And we can think about then all the countries around the world that have floating rate mortgages, and it introduces an element of difficulty in raising rates. We've had phenomenal advances in property prices, and now the big question is just how interest rate sensitive are economies. And it's not something that we're accustomed to because bond yields have been rising, but the dollar has been reasonably firm over the course of the last few months, not least because the big spending programs from the pandemic have now ended, so that is reducing the supply of new dollars. And because the additional big spending plans are foundering in Congress, well, then that's also helping to support the currency. And I think that's part of the reason why gold hasn't really gone anywhere. So we have inflationary pressures on the march, but then we also have less money printing, and that's helped to support some currencies. But then we come back to the bigger question, and it's that inflation is in large part a psychological phenomenon. And we can think about Milton Friedman and the fact that he said that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, but and of course that is true, but the psychology tends to come before the monetary, because we had massive protest movements in the 1960s, and there was the entire civil rights march movement, which had been gaining momentum for a decade. And then the popular protests against the Vietnam War really brought things to the fore. And then you had numerous assassinations. So you had a society in flux, everybody agitating for better standards of living, greater equality, more opportunity. And the only way to deliver that is with much easier monetary policy. So then you get this monetary policy easing, and then it starts to put downward pressure on the purchasing power of currencies. Inflationary pressures take off, wage demand growth takes off, and then you have people saying, well, that's a good thing, until people finally realize, and it does take time, that inflation is killing their ability to purchase. So then you get a change. And you need to have a good shock in order to change the psychology and allow politicians or to be elected who will then go ahead and try and impose fiscal austerity. But this, on this occasion, more from a populist or a popular-led support mechanism rather than it being imposed against the will of the population. And that's why I continue to think that we're at the beginning of the inflationary cycle, not the end. The late 1970s were the end of the inflationary cycle. What it suggests to me, therefore, is that it's only a matter of time before central banks figure out just how interest rate sensitive the bond markets are, the housing markets are, and the stock market is. And then they're going to have a rather difficult time continuing to raise rates. And it's at that point that gold will really take off. Now, of course, we've also had this big question about whether gold is pausing and hasn't really been performing as one might have hoped, because Bitcoin has taken away the, I guess, the animus from the market. Well, Bitcoin pushed on to new high ground in here today. So this is the completion of a 6 month or maybe a 7 month range. And it's rallying for a number of reasons. I think the first is that it's being parasitic on the rest of the sector. So there's the threat of regulation, and because there's a threat of regulation, then the risk in some of the more speculative coins is greater, and therefore Bitcoin should attract assets from them. So that's one. The next would be that Taproot is about to be released within the next 3 weeks. So then that's also going to be a significant bullish factor because it will address some of the long-standing questions that have been sitting around Bitcoin, most particularly about the speed of transactions. So this will be an additional network that will sit on top of the Bitcoin blockchain, and it won't need to be ratified every time there's a transaction, but simply when something is bought and then sold, it'll be then come back onto the network. And that's being viewed as a very positive development for the largest of the cryptocurrency projects. So prices continue to march higher. I don't believe, though, that the Bitcoin price is necessarily an inflation hedge. It looks to me to be more like a risk asset. The S&P 500 is right on the cusp of breaking out. It's at a new closing high. So with risk assets pushing on the upside, it would be hard to argue that Bitcoin's an inflation hedge, but rather it's more like a risk asset, or arguably some of these risk assets are behaving like inflation hedges, which would be the other way of thinking about it. And of course, stocks do tend to do well in the early portion of an inflationary environment because they get pricing power back and they get to raise prices. But of course, then input prices also start to bite, and then it's only companies that have got very strong positions overall get to continue to raise prices and preserve their margins. So that's obviously going to be beneficial for companies that have got subscription business models, and most particularly those that have invaluable services to provide. So Adobe was the very first company to adopt a subscription business model, and it remains in a bull market overall, and it's basically a proxy for the e-commerce sector, because when you're selling online, what you're effectively selling are photographs, and without Photoshop, then it becomes a lot more difficult. Microsoft is obviously another company with what is effectively an integral part of the global economy, and the share remains in a consistent advance overall. The other big development that we're starting to see within the technology sector is the introduction of the OEM business model to the automotive sector. So the Global X Autonomous and Electric Vehicles ETF is pushing on the upside. And that's both a reflection of margins within the sector because there's a lot of demand, there's less supply, and prices have risen as a result, and that's enabled some of these automotive companies to preserve their margins. But then it's also going to be highly disruptive because the barrier to entry for developing new cars has come down significantly because of the electric vehicle. And it's going to come down even further because of the introduction of the OEM manufacturing capacity. Because right now, any new automotive company, they might be able to skip some steps because of electric vehicles not having quite as many parts as an internal combustion engine driven vehicle, but they still have to go off and build the factory, and they still have to go off and employ people and be very capital intense. So instead now, with Foxconn looking at building its own factories, and it's already purchased Lordstown's, and it's going to be building Lordstown's cars. Well, then they're going to be able to offer manufacturing capacity to lots of new companies. Of course, there's been a lot of speculation over the years about whether Apple will go ahead and build a car. They don't want to get into manufacturing, and Therefore, the evolution of an OEM business model for the automotive sector is probably exactly what Apple has been waiting for. So what it suggests is that we're moving into a very competitive environment for the automotive sector globally. And that's not especially predicated on autonomy, which of course would be an additional massive disruptive influence on the wider market. And of course, Tesla remains really quite steady, and it is also a proxy for risk taking, and not least because they have a sizable holding in Bitcoin. Now, when we look at the wider market, the Chinese stock market was up over 1% today, and it was among the better performers internationally. And the H Share Index, which has a number of the larger tech companies as well as the banks in it, has also continued to rebound. So there's the potential here that what we're looking at is a type 2 bottom. We have the sequence of lower rally highs, which are easily evident, and then we also have failed downside breaks. So we're getting failed downside breaks, a loss of momentum, and now the price is rallying back up again. If it can take out the 9500 level, it will have broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and it will hold out the prospect for a massive reaction against the prevailing trend and a sizable rebound. Obviously, there are big questions about where the money is going to come from to fuel this, and Chinese property prices are starting to decline. And negative growth in property prices is problematic. So obviously, the Chinese government, they really wish to excise moral hazard from the system. But how can they do that and without significantly damaging the property market? And when we think about the USA, the Federal Reserve is alert to what happens with the stock market because lots of people own stocks. And in Europe, lots of people own bonds, and it makes the ECB alert to what happens in the bond markets. Well, in China, the majority of people own property, and it is usually the biggest asset that people have, and it's the go-to asset from a cultural perspective. And falling property prices have a significant effect on the wealth effect. So obviously, then China is trying to squeeze the property sector and trying to reduce risk in property developers, and they're trying to moderate speculation. And that's a long-term objective, and it's going to happen in fits and starts, but they can't tolerate falling property prices, and most particularly if the pace of that decline picks up. So it suggests that we are coming increasingly close to the turning of the credit impulse, and that should be beneficial for Chinese markets overall. Then we have the Nifty index, and it was down again in here today. So we are really quite overbought in the short term. There was a small downside key reversal yesterday, and then it followed through on the downside in here today. So we have a peak of near-term significance, and it's certainly not enough to question the consistency of the medium-term trend, but we are very overbought, so it really wouldn't be that surprising if we see at least some consolidation overall. Then the Indian rupee has also been quite weak, and there aren't that many currencies that are breaking down relative to the dollar. And we have the first evidence today that the Indian rupee is starting to steady. So, the stronger currency is also weighing on the stock market. And then we've had a very strong oil price, and the two countries that are big importers of oil are India and Japan. And Brent crude continues to steady, and it's holding this $85 area really quite admirably, and it's suggesting at least that we're still in a medium-term demand-dominated environment overall. And the copper price continues to rebound, And it's looking increasingly likely that it's going to push up and through that $5 area. And this looks like a bullish chart and a bullish consolidation in the region of the all-time peaks. So we're still in the secular bull market environment for copper. And we're also starting to see the precious metals, not just gold, starting to firm up as well. And silver in particular was stronger by 55 cents in here today, pushing now above the $24 area. Again, it has not quite yet broken the sequence of lower rally highs, but it is certainly looking more encouraging. And we've been through a sufficiently lengthy period of time where people are disgusted enough with it that with the precious metals sector that there is probably as much selling as was going to take place has already occurred. Platinum prices continue to firm from the $1,000 area and have clearly broken the sequence of lower rally highs. I was in an investment committee meeting yesterday, and the question of whether to continue to hold on to the gold positions came up, and I'm sure that most other investment committees have had exactly the same kind of discussion. And I was very active in arguing that we should hold on, and not arguing that we should buy more because we have plenty already. But the reality is that for the vast majority of people that were buying over the last few months, they're not in a profitable position. So there was certainly a willingness on the board to give me my way, but then people were inclined to be less forgiving in terms of waiting for it to come up, and thinking that if it goes up any bit at all, that we should probably sell and go looking for other opportunities. And this is one of the problems that when investment committees are chasing quarterly returns and you're dealing with an asset that is capable of going through medium-term corrections that last a year and longer, well, then you tend to get a lot of moving in and out of the asset class. And the price action is looking increasingly more favorable. But because people have been burnt, and because they've been disappointed and they've watched precious metals act as a drag on the performance of the portfolio for the last 6 and 7 months, well, then they're less willing to put more money to work. And this is a process that goes on, and it also goes right up against the newcomers. The people who have been buying in the last month have made money, and they're willing to put more money into the market. So eventually we're going to get back to a position where everybody's buying. And usually in precious metals, when everyone's buying and everyone is self-congratulatory and thinking that they've been had such forethought in positioning, well, then usually that's the beginning of the next medium-term correction. But I think that this one looks like it's ending. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.